Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And we have an empowerment hour for you. First, on health and nutrition, we're going to talk about pomegranates and endurance, University of Spain. Then taurine, it removes Alzheimer's plaques in mice from the Korea Institute of Science and Technology. Rosemary, very common herb, improves memory and cognition. Long-term vitamin E deficiency can cause cognitive dysfunction and elevate inflammation in the brain. Also, vitamin D deficiency and its relationship with endothelial dysfunction in Parkinson's, all important. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program, it's actually a couple, it's Professor David Montgomery and Ann Bilk. They're going to talk about the hidden half of nature, the correspondences between the microbial worlds in the soil, meaning the bacteria in the soil, and what we do with that food that's grown there and how that impacts the microorganisms in our body. He is a geomorphologist and environmentalist in the Earth and Space Sciences Division, University of Washington's College of Environment. It'll be an interesting discussion, something you wouldn't normally hear anyone discuss. Also, if time permits, from Juan Cole, the 10 signs U.S. is the most corrupt country in the world. And a commentary from Chris Hedges from the corporate capitalism is the foundation of a police brutality and prison state. Also, how the world leader signed a death warrant for the planet at the recent environmental conference by Marion Deschamps. And how terror attacks are great for the U.S. arms makers. ISIS literally just sent the bomb business booming, Matt Agarest. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. We know that we should be using vitamin D. If you get sunlight over about one-third of your body for about a half hour a day, that's good. Most people don't. In the wintertime in particular, because when people get up and go to work, if they commute, they're not getting sun. By the time they get home and out of work, 4:35, 5:30, it's dark. And then where are they getting their vitamin D? If they have the average American diet, they're not. This is from the Eju University in South Korea. And it says that when you have too little vitamin D, you increase early Parkinson's disease. And one of the things that I do, by the way, with all the people I counsel who have Parkinson's, is make sure they're getting more than enough vitamin D. And the amount that is generally recommended, 800 units a day, way too little. We should be recommending closer to 5,000 units a day. And for people with special conditions, it's going to go a lot higher than that. Just ask any of the holistic physicians and nurses, and they'll tell you, you need a good amount of vitamin D each day. But you also need vitamin E. This is from Wasadi University in Japan. And it says, a new study on diet nutrition, it says that when you have too little vitamin D, you end up with cognitive dysfunction and inflammation in the brain. So do we get vitamin E from the average American diet? Absolutely not. How much do we need then to have healthy functioning brain and turn off inflammation? I would suggest 400 units a day in the morning and in the evening. That's 800 units a day from mixed tocopherols rolls plus 200 units of tocotrienols. Now, a lot of people will get alpha tocopherol only. In my opinion, that's not enough because the gamma tocopherol, the G-A-M-M-A, gamma, it serves a lot of different ways in the body that alpha does not. So make sure you're getting the mixed tocopherol. That way you're getting a full spectrum, and that way you won't run these deficiencies. A good study on rosemary. And this is showing that it is able to help with impaired cognitive function. This was a study of adults who inhaled rosemary aroma, and it increased their alertness. So inhaling the fragrance of rosemary essential oil has been shown to increase the body's free radical scavenging activity, lower salivary cortisol levels, that's your stress hormone. And remember, you need a small amount of cortisol to regulate the body's response to stress. But when it's elevated because you're chronically stressed or you're acutely stressed, it's unhealthy. It can prematurely age us, and it's a major inflammatory. So when you breathe in the aromatherapies from rosemary, from an essential oil, what's actually happening? Well, you're getting the phytochemicals, including rosmarinic acid, camphor, caffeic acid, and antioxidant compounds, carnosinic acid, and carnosol. And the rosmarinic acid has been shown to have really good anti-inflammatory, antiviral, antibacterial, antidepressant, and anti-cancer properties. And the rosmarinic acid's anti-amyloid and antioxidant properties are protecting your nerves and your neurons from amyloid beta plaque that you see in people with Alzheimer's and dementia. So if you want to help someone who has memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, have them breathe in rosemary essential oil. Oh, you can put a diffuser in a room. You just put some of the oil in the diffuser, and the water comes up through a vapor, and it vibrates, goes into the air, and dispenses, and therefore you have this wonderful smell in the room. That's enough. That will work. That will help. And therefore you're helping people. And it's good science, always based upon excellent science. Who would have thought, right? Now then there is a particular nutrient. It's called taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E. And it's good because it's been shown to remove Alzheimer's plaques. This is from Korea Institute of Science and Technology. And it says, quote, Korean scientists have discovered a small molecule that destroys the protein plaques that build up in the brain of those in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. The molecule called 4-2-hydroxyethyl, 1, and then I'll spell this for you, PIPERAZINEPROPANESULPHONIC. It's an acid. Or for make it short and simple, EPPS. And it's almost identical to taurine. It's a type of amino acid found in different drinks, in fruit drinks mainly. So they're saying it has a lot of potential here. So just one more thing to take a look at. So when you see the name, you'll know that's good, and you'll go out of your way to find it and make sure that the person that needs it gets it. They don't eat a lot of it. And also pomegranates. Now, I'm a big believer in pomegranates. I believe we should be consuming it on a daily basis, and either as pomegranate fresh or pomegranate concentrate or pomegranate powder. Any and all of those are all good, but get it into your body. And this is one more reason why. This is from a University of Miguel Hernandez in Spain. And here's what the study that was published on their research shows. I'll quote, scientists in the University of Miguel Hernandez report that exercise can increase markers of oxidative stress, a reactive carbonyl compound. Consuming 200 milliliters per day of pomegranate juice, however, prevented these increases or actually decreased the levels. So, what's the message here? Exercise is important. Aerobic exercise is extremely important. But as I've mentioned many times, when you exercise, you increase free radicals, oxidative stress. That is not good. So you don't want that high oxidative stress, because oxidative stress creates free radicals, and the free radicals then cause inflammation and destroy your cells, damage your cells. So you need to grab those free radicals. Well, vitamin C does that. And coenzyme Q10 and zinc and many antioxidants do that. L-carnosine does it. Vitamin E really does it well. However, if you start taking vitamin C before you work out, you might end up with diarrhea. Afterwards, it's always important to take a super antioxidant to trap the free radicals that were generated from the exercise. This is saying that you could do the same thing with pomegranates. Now, you can eat the pomegranates, you can juice them, or get them in a powder. But then you benefit tremendously because you get all the good stuff from the exercise, none of the bad stuff from the free radicals. So pomegranates each day make a difference. And finally, a new study, vitamin C kills untreated or untreatable cancer cells. This is from Natural Health. I'll quote this. This is from a recent Science publication. Findings from new study offer further evidence of the cancer-fighting properties of vitamin C. This time, research shows the powerful antioxidant may be effective in combating a class of cancerous tumors, including colorectal cancer cells, that can be particularly difficult to treat by conventional means. Findings of the study, which showed the vitamin was effective in curbing cancer-causing mutations in mice, were published in a recent Journal of Science. Vitamin C is already known for its effectiveness in detoxifying the body and boosting the immune system, notably championed by globally respected scientist Dr. Linus Pauling and other advocates as a treatment for cancer and heart disease. These latest findings on vitamin C open the door for its use in more challenging cancers. It may sound incredible that a deadly disease like cancer could be treated by something as simple and safe as vitamin C. For decades, naysayers denied what Nobel Prize-winning chemist Pauling and others outside the conventional medical establishment had discovered. Vitamin C can be effective against many of the serious illnesses that have plagued mankind, including cancer. The most recently published study using cell cultures in mice showed that vitamin C was effective at killing tumor cells that carry a common cancer-causing mutation. So, that's it. That's good. The study was at Harvard Medical School, or study researchers from Harvard Medical School, Cornell Medicine, the Sidney Kimball Comprehensive Cancer Center, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and Tufts Medical Center teamed up to investigate the effects of high doses of vitamin C on colorectal tumor formation. Using roughly the equivalent of the amount of vitamin C found in 300 oranges, by the way, figure 30 milligrams per orange, you're dealing with 9,000 milligrams of vitamin C. That is what virtually everyone I advocate for uses. That's if these guys think that's really high, it is not high. But good, I'm glad that they had a chance to see that it worked and helped, and that's important. Now, just to comment on this, for 8 years, I worked with more than 3,000 individuals at the Tri-State Healing Center, first on 84th in Riverside in a brownstone, and then at 72nd in Broadway. 1,100 to 1,200 individuals had full-blown AIDS. We were able to stop in every single case pneumocystis crinii pneumonia and other life-challenging conditions of AIDS, including thrush, with anywhere from 100 to 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C, frequently 4 or 5 times a week. With people with advanced cancers, it was up to 200,000, plus a whole lot of other nutrients that were applied. And as a result, and during the whole time people were detoxified, as a result, we had remarkable changes. What was of interest is that when I would finish a group of patients at the center, we would write up the report on their outcomes and then send that out to all the different holistic doctors in the country. As a result, a lot of doctors were sending their patients that they could not help because they weren't using this. And one of the doctors in particular that we were working closely with was Dr. Robert Cathcart in California. And Cathcart's, virtually his entire practice was working with people with AIDS, defining illness. Now, he didn't go higher than 50,000 milligrams because he had been in contact with Dr. Frederick Klinner, North Carolina, and Klinner was the first doctor that I'm aware of to use 50,000 milligrams. But that, it was his upper limit. When I told Klinner that I was using 200,000 milligrams, he said, you know, that was rather remarkable. He never used it, but it didn't go higher. So now at least what we were doing from the 1980s through the 90s and on to this day, helping thousands of people reverse disease. Many full-blown AIDS patients totally cured, appeared on Tony Brown's journal, appeared at a press conference of physicians, over 100 physicians and scientists, but no one from the media. They chose not to come. Appeared at a church on Central Park West. 1,600 people that day for 12 hours came, and all scientists around the world and physicians who were using alternative natural means were there. Not a single member of the medical establishment, scientific community, or the AIDS community came to see what we were doing with AIDS. So you see, we are already aware of all this. I'm glad to see that these prestigious institutions are at least looking at what they consider large amounts of vitamin C that are really not, and seeing remarkable improvements. So that's good. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Nall. What happens when a police officer pulls over a person and asks them, do you have a driver's license? The person says yes. Do you have insurance? The person says yes. And the person goes to get the driver's license and the insurance. The person says, don't. Don't touch that glove compartment. The person says, okay. And then the police officer gives the person a ticket for not being able to prove that they had insurance. Now think of that. You have it. What was the equation here? Oh, I forgot. The person was black. So just imagine what happens when a person is pulled over. Would this have happened to a Caucasian? Would this would have happened to a Caucasian in a business suit or a woman in a business suit?
So here it is, y'all. I'm in my car. Lady pulled me over talking about I didn't have a front license plate. Not only did I go way beyond her, the two more cars come between us, and I was over in the other lane, and she both of them moved to the side just to pull me over to say I did not have a front license plate. Now, when she came to the car, she asked, did you have a driver's license? I said, yes. I have to look for it, though. It's in my glove department. She said, no, I don't know what you're reaching for. Do not reach for it. Okay. So she's like, just give me your name. I gave her my name. Then she asked me my number. I said, what you need my number for? And she said, well, they told me to have it. So then, after all this, she said, do you have insurance? I said, yes, I have insurance. She said, then she said, okay, dear. I said, okay, I have to reach for that as well. Let me grab it. She said, no, I don't know what you're reaching for. Do not grab it. Just tell me who it's through. So then I told her, it's through State Farm. So then she come back, I'm only giving you a $10 ticket for not having proof of insurance. What? I got proof of insurance. You told me not to reach for it because you're scared of me. Now I have my do-rag on granted because I'm trying to keep my waves nice. But that ain't got nothing to do with her. The reason for you to do your job is me to reach for something. Then she come to the car and I said, you told me not to reach for it. She said, yeah, because I don't want anybody reaching for things around me. Now here's my conclusion. It's not just anybody. She don't want me reaching for things because I'm a black man. So she don't want me to reach for anything. So then she go back and she say, you know what, I was only gonna get a $10 ticket. Now I'm gonna get another ticket. Well, now from this point on, I'm already mad, so do whatever it is you gotta do. Do whatever it is you gotta do to give me a ticket. Do whatever it is you gotta do, because I'm not worried, I ain't do nothing wrong. It's just the fact that cops are racist and a lot of people is ignorant to it. This is called racism. I got racial profile because I'm a black man driving a nice vehicle. But they didn't even think I had insurance. So when I reach to show you my proof of insurance, you get scared and you just assume I don't have any. As if I'm lying, what I'm gonna reach for? What I reach for a football? I'm gonna reach for one of my books? Huh? What I'm gonna reach for? Ain't nothing else in my car. You can see my back seat. The whole point is that I'm a black man and you want to pull me over because you're racist. Now you're sitting here wasting my time. I got things to do. We've been here for probably over 20 minutes right now, just sitting here. She ain't got nothing better to do. You gonna pull me over for a front license plate? Granted, y'all, I live on the other side of town. I mean, I just drove through the whole downtown right next to the police station, drove past 15 other cops. And now I'm getting pulled over because I ain't got this. And this is the racist cop that just giving me a ticket because of the fact that I ain't got a front license plate. And I got insurance that she did not want me to reach for. And I have license that she did not want me to reach for because she's scared of me. Because I'm a black man and she's very scared. This is the kind of cop that'll shoot you right here. This is the kind of cop that will shoot you.
You have a court date.
Yeah, you can give me my ticket, ma'am. Go.
$63.
Oh, I ain't worried about it. Money is no problem with me. I don't have any problem. You got anything else for me?
You have your index finger?
You're not touching my finger. No, you're not. You had the chance to get my license.
No,
you asked me out to grab it.
All over for it.
What do you mean
car?
Reaching all? This is my car.
Yes.
What am I gonna reach for? A Bible?
No,
my books? What am I gonna reach for?
Car.
What am I gonna reach for? Look
know.
At my car. You are very afraid. You should not be a cop. You cannot do this job. You are not good at what you do.
Okay.
You are
okay.
Very
okay.
Afraid. I will not give you my index finger. I'm terribly sorry. Do whatever you call more people. I'm scared. I feel offended. No, I feel offended. No.
Back license plate and cover off of it.
I am scared. I don't have to take off my cover.
Okay.
You lost your dang on mine. I don't have to take off the cover off my license plate. That ain't nothing but a tint. You can see through it perfectly.
Well, it's
no,
still illegal
no.
In the state of Wisconsin.
It's not illegal because this is not the first time I've been pulled over. It's not illegal. And matter of fact, I'm not giving you my index finger. Do whatever you gotta do.
Okay.
Call somebody else if you need to. You ain't getting it. It ain't gonna happen.
That's
plain
right.
And simple.
You have a good day, sir.
You do have a great day. Racist as you can possibly be.
That's an unusual conversation. We should think about that. What would happen if we were pulled over and we were put in the same situation, being given a ticket for something we hadn't done? We have our license, we have our insurance, and yet we're given a ticket for both as if we didn't. Now, before I go to a commentary here in a moment, the government is now arresting people for anti-Obama post. And this is from the president that many people on the left and liberal community voted for based upon someone who would not in any way censor freedom of speech.
Case of Brandon Robb. He's a 26-year-old decorated Marine veteran who served in both Iraq as well as Afghanistan. He was arrested and put into a psychiatric institution last August for some incendiary Facebook posts.
You will not violate my rights.
Here's video of Brandon Robb's arrest. He was detained without charges and was ordered to spend up to 30 days in a psych ward, but that court order was later dismissed. Now, Brandon Robb is suing the government for infringing on his First Amendment rights. Yesterday, I spoke with his lawyer, John Whitehead. He's a constitutional attorney at the Rutherford Institute, and I asked him to go into more detail about Brandon's arrest and what has happened in the year since.
Well, he was arrested for Facebook posts, and then taken into custody and eventually put in a mental hospital. And so the Facebook posts were basically his complaining about the way the government is operating. He was again arrested handcuffed behind his back. We actually called the police and said, what are the charges? They said, oh, he's not charged with any crime. So we eventually got him out of the mental hospital in about a week, and we had a judge actually rule who released him that there was no credible evidence whatsoever to hold him. And so within this last about 8 or 9 months that we've been preparing for this lawsuit, assembled a legal team, and we filed a First Amendment, a Fourth Amendment case today in federal district court in Richmond, and a false imprisonment case. So he was arrested for his First Amendment activities, and he was searched and seized without probable cause. The government did not even have a search warrant because they did not have enough evidence to get it. There is no evidence of him ever owning a gun. In fact, he doesn't own a weapon, so obviously he wasn't dangerous. And so I see this case basically as a shot across the bow, telling the government, before you do this, you need to follow the Constitution, and you need to do your work, your homework. Don't go around harassing veterans.
And we'll get to your lawsuit in just a second. As you had mentioned, U.S. Circuit Court Judge Alan Sharrett acknowledged the fact that the authorities had broken Brandon Robb's First, Fourth, Fifth, and 14th Amendment rights. Was there any sort of apology issued?
No. In fact, I had veterans groups have called me around the country. This has happened to other veterans. A lot of them, they've not been taken into custody, but the FBI is actually showing up their doorstep saying, we're investigating text messages, emails. The National Security Agency contacted one veteran and said he read his emails. They were concerned. So this is a national phenomenon. And again, the Robb case is basically saying, if you're going to do this, you're going to get sued.
So talk about the lawsuit. What is the lawsuit that you are currently filing? And who are you suing? What type of reparations are you hoping for in this case?
Well, we're suing the police officers, the FBI, Secret Service, a psychiatrist who did a short examination of him while he was in jail, and some other employees of the so-called commission that had him arrested, basically, and taken into custody. Again, we're hoping that, Brandon Robb will get some compensation.
Keep in mind, what you're hearing, and I will be having him as a guest and his lawyer, is a person who is not happy with the way our government and the Defense Department is conducting our foreign policy, what we have done to other countries in the name of peace, freedom, and democracy. And for that, he was arrested and put into a psychiatric hospital. But now we're finding out that this is true of people in all different types of groups around the United States, environmental groups, anti-GMO groups. You're now on watch lists. And then they keep everything secret, and yet they have the full power to examine every single email, every single phone call, every single text, be at every meeting, monitor everything. So when you say something against the government, against corporate America, you're now considered an enemy of the state. Just let you know, when I've done my specials on fascism USA and how we become a police state, it's not hypothetical. And this evening, I will have two of the leading thinkers on this subject in the world. Chris Hedges will be on, and we will talk about this in great depth, about specifically how the liberal class has betrayed its own base and are participating in the tyranny that we're experiencing. That's 7 o'clock in the Progressive Commentary Hour. Now let's go over and say hello to Professor David Montgomery and Ann Bilk. He is a geomorphologist and an environmentalist. And we're here to talk about the bacteria in nature, the bacteria in our bodies. And let's see if they're both on the phone here. Hi.
Yeah, hi. How are,
David,
how are
Ann?
You? Hello.
Hi, Ann. Nice to have you both with us today. And Ann, by the way, is David's wife. She's a biologist and environmental planner whose work includes watershed restoration and advancing public health through environmental initiatives. And they are the author of Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. And together, their most recent book is The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health, that exposes the critical role of microbiomes in our soil and in our guts, and how both of these are necessary in a healthy way to contribute to our life. Their website is dig2grow.com. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'd like to begin with the recent Paris Climate Conference in the background, because today with climate change, our nation is facing a critical threat in food security in the future, water security in the future, mass migration of individuals, what I would consider a high probability that there will be at different places in the world water wars, conflicts based upon scarce resources and who has any control or use of them. And yet, this is not on the table. People have come away saying, including many liberals, all this was really good. I think the entire episode was a fraud. I'm not alone. Marion Deschamps wrote just, quote, the world leaders signed a death warrant for the planet at the recent conference. Quote, on Saturday night, 195 countries agreed on a climate deal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions after 2 weeks of painful negotiations. And then it says that it's historic, and the President of the United States says, quote, the best chance to save the one planet we have. And then it goes on to talk about how nothing was concrete that would actually be done. And to add to that is something that James Hansen, the father of climate change awareness, calls, and this is from The Guardian, from Oliver Millman, quote, the former NASA scientist James Hansen, considered the father of global awareness of climate change, is a soft-spoken Iowan. But when he talks about the gathering of nearly 200 nations, his demeanor changes. Quote, it's a fraud, really, a fake, he says, rubbing his head. It's just BS for them to say, well, we'll have a 2 degrees Celsius warming target and then try to do a little better every 5 years. It's just worthless words. There's no action, just promises. As long as fossil fuel appears to be the cheapest fuels out there, they will be continue to be burned. And then we find out today that India says they're going to double the amount of coal they're using in the next 5 years. And China is not going to reduce its reliance upon coal. It's increasing it. And no one in the United States in an official position has committed to an actual committed cause of reducing global warming. And the average American either doesn't believe in global warming and as a result is not interested. So that's the backdrop that I would like you to address in your discussions. So take us through this now so people can understand that this is the most exacerbating by an agricultural industry that destroys the energetic life in the soil. The same polluters, by the way, the same polluters that, you know, that put the soot in the air. Where's the soot go? It goes in the air, goes to the ground, and the pollution of our water, it also goes into the ground, into our lakes and streams and tributaries. And so the industries that are causing this are destroying the energetic life in soil, and therefore it's not rejuvenative and relies upon toxic pesticides and fertilizers and GMOs and monocrop farming to bring food to our tables. And there's no resilience in this method of farming, and we're already witnessing the results of this horrendous experiment. Lower crop yields, produce with less nutrients, super weeds and super pests, and increasing evidence that today's big agricultural food is a threat to human health. So please begin there and tell us a bit about the microbiome of organisms that live in soils that bring us the most nutritious foods, and why it's so critically important for future food security that the microbiome in the soil be preserved and regenerated. The forum is yours.
All right. Well, where to begin? That's a lot of topics. But if you look at the issue you brought up about food security, that sort of underlies a lot of these, the concern about the next, say, 50 to 100 years. If you turn and look in the rearview mirror, and you look at the places in the world today that are already kind of perpetually troublesome geopolitical hotspots, places like Syria, Libya, Nigeria, they're places where long-term soil degradation has impacted the population. And so as we may be seeing future conflicts over water, we also ought to be concerned about essentially humanity's distribution of arable, productive, fertile land, because we've been degrading that literally since the dawn of agriculture, and we don't really have any new places to go to that we haven't tried farming yet that could be where it could be sustained over the long run. And farming practices have greatly run down soil fertility in many different areas, and not just modern farming practices. The practices that used the plow did the similar things. And one of the biggest disappointments on my end in terms of what happened recently in Paris, and there was actually progress, whether it was enough, you know, we can, people will be arguing about for a lot, but I think the really clear opportunity we missed even putting on the table to discuss is actually using global soil restoration, trying to rebuild the fertility and biology and organic matter in the world's agricultural soils as a way to help partially offset greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time help ensure food security for future generations by rebuilding soil fertility that they're going to need to rely on to be able to continue to produce enough food to actually feed the world. And that was essentially sort of taken off the table in Paris. There was a side agreement by a number, I think 20-some-odd countries, that agreed to look into sort of more current farming practices that are of the kind that we talk about in the book when we, after we go through the role of microbial life in supporting soil fertility and actually farming practices that cultivate the beneficial microbes, the beneficial fungi, the mycorrhizal fungi and bacteria in the soil that produce compounds that help plants grow and that also help wrest nutrients out of the rocks and get them into plant life, make them available to plant life, because you know, we can't eat rocks, plants can't eat rocks, we need microbes to break them down for us to try and get them into soluble forms that plants can take up and then that we can either eat or eat the things that eat them. There's a whole new view of fertility and soils that's emerged over the last 20 years or so in terms of the role of soil life, soil biology, bacteria and fungi in the soil, the hidden half of nature, the parts that's too small to see and it's out of sight below ground, in supporting the fertility of the soil and the growth of the world of nature that we see above ground all around us, the kind of nature that Anne as a biologist and me as a geologist trained to see and understand. And we've literally been going through a revolution in thought about what microbes do in terms of supporting the larger world of life as we've come to understand more about what microbial communities do. For 100, 150 years, we've looked at microbes dominantly as pests and pathogens, both in agriculture and in medicine, and through the lens of what's called germ theory, the idea that each disease, a crop disease or a human disease, that there's one microbial pathogen that's actually the vector for causing it. And there's a good reason we use germ theory to look at pathogens. It works pretty well for a lot of pathogenic organisms. But what we've overlooked and are just starting over the last few years to actually unravel and understand scientifically are how the communities of beneficial organisms in the soil actually support the health of plants, support the growth of nutritious foods, and support our own health from deep within our own bodies.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And part of your adventure into exploring the links and synergies between the microbiome in soil and the microbiome in our gut that is essential for probiotic activities to keep the body healthy and defend itself against diseases was your own bout with cancer. And what you both found were strong similarities between the role of bacteria in the roots of plants and the bacterial cultures that live inside your guts in a way that reminds me of the essential principles of ancient philosophy, such as the laws of correspondence. And I'd like for you to share that with us now.
Sure, Gary. Yeah, that was one of the most fascinating realizations that we came to around, you know, middle toward the end of writing the book, because we had been reading a lot about plant science and about all of the ways in which the microbial world underpins the health of plants. Some of the things Dave just mentioned, this transfer of various nutrients and minerals in the soil, that all of that is microbially mediated. And then when we turn to human health and begin reading, you know, immunology and gastroenterology and so forth, it was really interesting. Many of the same processes and even in some cases some of the same words and phrases we were coming across. One of the things that most struck us is the word exudates. So exudates are the photosynthetically produced carbohydrates that plants will shunt down to their roots, and then they will release them from their roots, and that draws all kinds of beneficial soil life right to the root surface. And in our guts, there's a similar area. It's the lining of our colon, in fact. It's got a thick layer of mucus on it, and some of that mucus is made of exudates that our colon cells release. So here we were, you know, reading in these and writing in these two different areas, the botanical world and the human world, and all of a sudden we see, this is sort of sounding like the same thing. And of course, in our case, you know, people eat food that wends its way down the digestive tract. Much of the plant food that we eat, we don't have the proper enzymes to digest that, and it lands in our colon. And guess who does have the right enzymes to digest that? Our microbiome. And as they, you know, work through the plant foods that are part of our diet, what really blew us away was to learn that the byproducts of the microbial breakdown of organic matter, if you will, our plant foods, our plant-based diet, turn into some absolutely medicinal compounds. There's three in particular that have been studied and been shown to have benefits, and it's a group of three different types of fatty acids. And so that we began to learn those kinds of things, and what we sort of came away from by the end of the book is that the root is the gut, and the gut is the root. And so that you elevate that to sort of a bigger picture, and it becomes very important what we put into our soil, both the soil in the fields beneath our feet, and if you will, this sort of inside version of soil that is in our colon. And what it basically comes down to is all of this talk about fiber that maybe people have heard their doctors talk about or their spouses or somebody. That fiber is the part of the plant world that the microbes in our gut are able to break down, and they actually ferment it. So we had a name for these microbiota. We called them our fiber fermenters. And we boiled boiled this whole picture of how things are working in the gut down into six words. And being a gardener, of course, I love the words that we picked because they are mulch your soil inside and out. And so that was sort of the big picture that we came away from the book with.
Well, man, that's a terrific analogy. And for this audience, there is a concept. It's called a hermeticism, and it's based on the laws of correspondence and vibration. And this audience knows I speak a lot about vibration, the vibration of a person, the positive or negative vibration of a food like sugar, meat, alcohol, chemicals, negative, positive vibration, fruits, berries, plant-based, organic versus GMO. And briefly, this states that there are hidden correlations or correspondences between the outer and inner environments, and this interconnection is maintained through laws of energy and vibration. And therefore, what we witness in our outer lives, such as the soil's microbiome, can also be witnessed, as you just stated very articulately, as intrinsic to our inner lives, such as the bacterial communities living in our gut. And so I'm just happy to know that you've got a very important message out there, and we all should be living it. And our grandparents did. They knew that a healthy diet, a healthy body, a sick diet, a sick body, and the bacteria in our guts the flora in our guts, feed it the right nutrients, the right fibers from nuts and seeds, legumes and beans and grains and starchy vegetables, and it thrives. Feed it toxins, and it doesn't. So, David and Anne, thank you for being on, and all the best in this effort to educate the public. And again, their website is DIG, D-I-G, the numeral 2, grow.com, and their newest book is The Hidden Half of Nature, an outstanding work, and I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. Now for Donald Trump, and I'm sure a lot of other individuals in this presidential race, here are some Muslims that you don't know, and you really should.
I am Muslim, but I'm not angry.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not forced to wear a headscarf.
I'm Muslim, but I don't wear the hijab.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not dangerous unless we're on the dance floor.
I'm Muslim, but I don't care if you're Shia or Sunni or Sufi, embrace them all.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not a terrorist.
But I'm not a terrorist.
But I'm not a terrorist.
But I'm not stopped at airports because my name is Tom and I'm white.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not Arab.
I am Muslim, but I love Jews.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not an immigrant.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not homophobic.
But I'm not prejudiced towards others.
But I don't hate America.
I'm Muslim, but I'm not easily offended.
I'm Muslim, but I don't look like one.
I am Muslim, but I had bacon one time on accident. It was good.
I'm Muslim, but I don't scream Allahu Akbar randomly out loud.
I am Muslim, but I wasn't the one who told kids that there was no Santa.
I'm Muslim, but you can be whatever you want to be.
I'm Muslim, and I'm a feminist.
I'm Muslim, and I believe in equality.
I'm Muslim, and I'm descended from pilgrims on the Mayflower.
I'm Muslim, and I love listening to rap music.
I am Muslim, and I love Thanksgiving.
And I was born and raised in Los Angeles.
And I'm an actress. I am Muslim, and I love dancing.
And I'm a spoken word poet.
And I'm a hip-hop artist, and I ride a motorcycle.
And I love Ohio State football.
I'm Muslim, and I love smiling.
I'm a Muslim, and I date, even though my parents hate it.
I'm Muslim and I like to surf.
And I'm a writer.
And my best friends are not Muslim.
And I'm a convert. What, what?
I'm Muslim and that doesn't contradict with being American.
I'm Muslim and my religion teaches me to love everyone.
Just a few messages for the Donald. And this is a message for everyone who believes in the ideals of corporate America, something that I believe we should take a moment, pause, and reflect on. Our national conversation on race and crime, according to Chris Hedges, is based upon a fiction. It is the fiction that the organs of internal security, especially the judiciary and the police, can be adjusted, modernized, or professionalized to make possible a post-racial America. We discuss issues of race while ignoring the economic, bureaucratic, and political systems of exploitation. All of it legal and built into the ruling apparatus that are the true engines of racism and white supremacy. No discussion of race is possible without a discussion of capitalism and class. And until that discussion takes place, despite all the proposed reforms to the criminal justice system, the state will continue to murder and imprison poor people of color with impunity. More training, body cameras, community policing, the hiring of more minorities as police officers, a better probation service, and more equitable fines will not blunt the indiscriminate use of lethal force or reduce the mass incarceration that destroys the lives of the poor. Our capitalist system callously discards surplus labor, especially poor people of color, employing lethal force in the largest prison system in the world to keep them under control. This is by design, and until this predatory system of capitalism is destroyed, the poor, especially people of color, will continue to be gunned down by police in the streets, as they have for decades, and disproportionately locked up in prison cages. The Strength of the New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander is that by equating mass incarceration with Jim Crow, it makes it rhetorically impossible to defend it. Well, just think of that for a moment. Racism in America will not be solved by teaching tolerance and creating colorblind institutions. The refusal to confront structural racism, which is in the 1930s and 40s among intellectuals, situated domestic racism and colonization abroad in an integrated critique of global capitalism, so she said, led to a vapid racial liberalism that, as Penny von Eschen writes, conceived of racism as a prejudice and a personal and psychological problem rather than as a systemic problem rooted in specific social practices and prevailing relations of political and economy and culture. In essence, police brutality will not be solved by reforms that mandate an acceptable use of force. The state may have outlawed lynchings and mob violence, largely because of international outcry and damage to the image of the United States abroad, but insisted that capital punishment could be fair with adequate legal defense for the poor and proper jury instruction and clear lists of mitigating and aggravating circumstances. Well, it can't. All penal reform from President Truman's 1947 Committee on Civil Rights report to the Safe Streets Act of 1968, to the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, to contemporary calls for more professionalism in efforts to deal with the resources of the police, does nothing, zero, to blunt police abuse or reverse mass incarceration. It does nothing to address the bias of white supremacy. Truman's version of the civil rights agenda came through lynching. According to one author on the subject, it illuminates how the rule of law and white supremacy operate hand in hand. Lynching hurt U.S. credibility. It hurt its forced projection abroad. The concern over lynching was not a concern for black lives. It was a concern for that the mob and state violence were too easily conflated. The objective became to make a sharp difference between white supremacists mob violence and white supremacist state violence. The difference is not that one is white supremacist and one is not. The difference is one is proceduralized, one is rights-based, one is orderly, bound by rule of law, with ever more elaborate procedures. That is the only thing that makes it different from the lynch mob. The real crime, poverty, institutional racism and capitalist exploitation is rarely discussed. Therefore, the blame for crime is easily shifted to the pathology of black families, we're told. The Moynihan Report, for example, argues that black criminality results from dominant black mothers and absent black fathers. In other words, as liberals and conservatives became convinced that the machinery of the judiciary and the police was largely impartial and fair, the onus for punishment shifted to the victims. State-sponsored white violence remained entrenched. Institutionalized murder remained acceptable in the minds of liberals and conservatives. Those who were arrested, locked up, or shot deserved to be arrested, locked up, or shot. Federal mandatory minimum statutes tripled under President Bill Clinton. And this is one example of how, with each administration, layer to protect African Americans from lawless racial violence, liberals propelled the development that, through perverse turns, expanded lawful racial violence. In 1993, one author quotes, African Americans accounted for 88.3% of all federal crack cocaine distribution convictions. And because the judicial system is stacked against poor people of color, it does not matter, she said, if the arresting officers are also people of color. Quote, there is no evidence that having a minority police officer changes arrests or use of force. The better evidence suggests that black police officers tend to arrest everyone at higher rates across the races. I interpret this as black professionals have to overperform in any number of professions to get comparable ranking. Maybe interpersonally people find it a little less offensive, but it does not diminish the violence. By the Clinton administration, liberals and conservatives were competing with each other to be tough on crime. And that between 1968 and 76, no one was executed in the United States, but this changed under Bill Clinton. Democrats and Republicans proposed bill after bill until the number of crimes punishable by death leapt from one, just one, in 1974 to 66 in 1994. Two parties engaged in a death penalty bidding war. Then Senator Joe Biden was one of the most enthusiastic proponents of expanding the death penalty. He boasted that he had, quote, added back to the federal statutes over 50 death penalties. And the Democrats effectively, quote, neutralized soft-on-crime accusations with punitive outbidding. But while this may have been politically advantageous to the Democrats, it was devastating to poor people of color, and in particular blacks. So think of these things. The idea that we can put police officers through training to address their implicit bias and then give them guns, the idea that 2 days of intensive training will diminish the probability to shoot to kill, is absurd. I want to thank everyone for listening. Don't forget tonight, 7 o'clock, got a powerful hour. Dr. Norman Pollack, Professor Norman Pollack, Chris Hedges, two of the greatest thinkers, and we're going to take on the liberal establishment tonight. And they should have a real challenge for how corrupt they've become and how they betrayed their base. That's tonight, 7 p.m., the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.